I got a postcard in the mail this week from my optometrist. Seems that he's been keeping track of things, and I do recall that it was 2 years ago this month that my wife and I each got our new, not really so new anymore, but at that time our new eyeglasses, and they still seem perfectly functional to me, but my optometrist seems to think that if after a couple of years have gone by, I at least need to come in and have my eyes examined once again. He's a nice man, but he's kind of irritating. He tells me that as you get older, you need to have these exams frequently, so that's a little bit unnecessary, but it is important, of course, that we take care and we do what we can so that we can keep our vision sharp and clear. There are a lot of analogies, aren't there, between physical eyesight and spiritual vision. We don't plan to get into deeply a lot of those analogies. You're probably familiar with them. I'm sure you've heard them. You can easily understand that Scripture uses a great deal of comparison or analogy between physical or spiritual blindness and not being able or willing to hear or understand God's instruction. So it's something that we learn that vision, both in a physical and in a spiritual way, is very important. The message I want to share with you this afternoon has to do with vision, has to do with what we see and what we perceive. And let me go ahead and admit right up front that this is a kind of a personal approach today, kind of a contemplative approach to a sermon. Maybe that's just an excuse for not being very organized, but we'll go with contemplative. It's just been some things that I've been thinking about, some things that have been on my mind during this last week in particular, and a couple of weeks in a more general sense. For me, this last week has been very difficult. Not a pleasant week in my view, in my experience. The news that we saw on television has just been heart-wrenching. It's just been difficult to watch and to see. The worst of the storm went through Hurricane Sandy, and then the nor'easter that enveloped it went through the eastern seaboard early in the week. The news since then has just been so painful to see the suffering that's taking place. And even after that, the weather here locally, it started last Saturday, and I think twice in 8 days now I've actually seen a little bright spot in the sky. Just the weather itself has just been gloomy and cold and depressing. I've had to kind of struggle against that sense or that feeling. I get kind of a when I get anxious, when I get concerned, I get kind of a familiar feeling, kind of a knot in my stomach. And I've experienced that a lot this week, not just because of the weather, but other things as well. I find, of course, a great deal of comfort in being here with you today. I'm not in a bad mood, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to snap at you. But it's just been a tough week. And sometimes we have weeks that are like that, that are unpleasant, that are not the kind of week that we would like to have. And so feeling this way kind of led me to do a little personal review and to review some scriptures that I felt for me were helpful and that helped me to refocus and to consider things from a little different perspective, to exercise a little different kind of vision. We might note that today is November 3rd, and 1 month ago Thursday, day before yesterday, was the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles. In some ways, it seems like a lot longer ago than that. Time does that to us sometimes, but to me, it seems like it was more than a month ago that the Feast of Tabernacles was getting underway. I'm sure it was a very positive experience. People I've talked to have expressed that it was a very uplifting, very encouraging, and inspiring feast this year. Why was it? If your feast was inspiring and uplifting, if you have good memories of this year's feast, what was it that caused that? What made the holy days special this year for you? Was it the significance and the meaning of the days, what they represent? Was it the messages that you heard during that three-week stretch between the Feast of Trumpets and the Last Great Day? Was it the fellowship you enjoyed, especially at the Feast of Tabernacles, having the opportunity to be with friends and to make new friends for that whole week? Maybe you traveled someplace you hadn't been before, back to someplace that you really enjoy going to. Was it because of the break in your routine? You got out of the everyday pattern of life and had something different, a little time, extra time to relax, and maybe you even had a little bit of extra cash with that festival tithe? Well, probably it was either some or all of the above that made the Feast of Tabernacles in particular. And when we talk about the fall holy days, we always kind of focus on the Feast of Tabernacles. But when I refer to that, I mean the whole season, including all four of the days that we observed. Even during those special times, we have our own struggles and trials. But it seems like even though we sometimes have difficulties during the holy days, we're always able to benefit from the meaning and the focus that we have. It becomes the highlight of our year. But with the Feast of Tabernacles and Last Great Day, the fall holy day season over for another year, sometimes the excitement kind of fades. We feel it's difficult in some ways for us to readjust to coming back home at the end of those days. But I want to focus on something this afternoon that I found important to remember. And that is that the hope and the optimism, the expectation we have as we observe the Feast of Tabernacles should be something that continues well beyond that week. That we should not allow that sense of purpose and of understanding and of vision to be overcome by anxieties and concerns and the challenges of this world. It's difficult to come home from an occasion where we're looking ahead to the world tomorrow only to have to deal with the world today. I see always, and I think I felt in particular this year, such a contrast between what we were observing, what we were celebrating during those holy days, and what the world is like now. The world tomorrow versus the world today. The title I've given to this message today is Our 1 Month Vision Exam. Our 1 Month Vision Exam. My optometrist wants me to come back every 2 years to have my eyes examined. Maybe it would do well to give me to examine my head, not just my eyes. But I want to focus back just a few weeks and talk about the vision that we had when we came home or when we were experiencing the fall holy days, and how that is holding up against the challenges of the world that we live in, that we come back home to. And we talked about this, the contrast between the world today and the world tomorrow before we went to the feast. And maybe it seems like we're just still talking about the same thing. But now I'm looking at it from a different perspective. Now I'm looking at the contrast between the promised world tomorrow and the world we live in today from the perspective of having observed those holy days and the danger or the possibility of that vision becoming overshadowed by the difficulties or the challenges that we face in today's world. We must come home. We don't live in that kingdom yet. Turn to John chapter 17. John the 17th chapter. Consider a statement that Jesus made here to his disciples and by extension to us. Before, we'll start in verse 20, here in John 17, Jesus said, I do not pray. This is a prayer. He's speaking to the Father. He says, I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. So in other words, Jesus is looking ahead to the time when others will become disciples as well. And this prayer, according to that statement, actually applies to us. The prayer that Jesus gave on this occasion was for those who in the future would also become his disciples. So with that in mind, drop that back to verse 15. John chapter 17, verse 15. Jesus said, I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. Jesus prayed for the protection of his disciples as we live in this world. Like I said before, this world is not an easy place to come back to from the Feast of Tabernacles. I've had a very uneasy feeling all week long. It's been in the news, things that are unsettling and disturbing. And as we return to the world, as we return to our homes, having celebrated the future, it's not always easy to readjust to the present. God's truth sets us apart. It helps us to view things and to live in a way that's different. It says, they're not of the world, just as I am not of the world. One of the contrasts that I have observed and given some thought to is the difference between celebrating the time when Jesus Christ will rule over this earth, and he will rule with perfect justice, and he will restore the world to the condition it should be, and it'll be the time of the restitution of all things. To compare that to the final stages of this nation choosing its next leader. What an amazing contrast it is that we have been celebrating the time when Jesus Christ will rule over this earth. And we come back and all that we see are all around us is all this clamor and all of this debate and all this hassling and accusation and mudslinging and claims made by a couple of different men. And I don't take away from their sincerity. I'm not going to get political here. But two very different personalities, very different style and approach of leadership that they claim that they would offer. And this nation is divided right down the middle, almost exactly even in that choice. So somebody is going to be very unhappy in a few days. And all the efforts and all the endless politicking and claims and promises just begins to kind of wear on us. Probably you saw, most of us this week may well have seen the video of this little girl, this little four-year-old girl, and it's been all over TV and the internet, but she is just sobbing, she is just weeping, she is just so devastated, and her mother on this video asked, well, honey, what's wrong, what are you crying about? And I don't remember the exact words, but something to the effect that I'm so tired of Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. That's all this, even this four-year-old girl. Her mother said, well, honey, don't worry. It'll be over soon. And she, okay. That's kind of the way I think a lot of us feel, is that, you know, this just soon it'll be over. And it's just such an emptiness to see all the hope and all the expectation that so many have, that if their guy somehow gets in there, that he's going to take care of us and lead us back to peace and prosperity. Turn to Matthew 28. I'm weary. I'm so tired of the whole scene. And I feel like this little four-year-old girl. I just want it to be done so I don't have to see all those commercials anymore and hear all the debates and all the argument back and forth and these all the clamor of the race and of the effort. Matthew 28. As I said, when we were at the observing these fall holy days, we were looking ahead to the time when Jesus Christ is going to take control of this earth. That's a comforting expectation and hope. It allows us to see other things from a whole different perspective as we look ahead to the time when he will take that responsibility. But I think that's an important statement he makes here. Now, this is Matthew 28. It's after Christ has been resurrected, and he has appeared to his disciples a couple of times, and he's about to spend about 6 weeks with them, as we see in the first chapter of Acts. But he makes this statement to them in chapter 28, verse 18. Jesus spoke to them, to the disciples, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." See, Jesus Christ is not just going to take control when he returns. I'm sure we read, I know we did before the feast, on the Feast of Trumpets, and probably later in the feast as well, wherever you were, Revelation 11:15, where the announcement is made that Jesus Christ has come and he will take charge over the nations and he will rule the nations. But his authority doesn't begin there. Jesus has already been given authority over all things in heaven and on earth. In other words, as we see what's happening in the world around us, we can be assured that it's not just running without any control or Satan's completely in charge. We know he's the God of this world, but ultimately, Jesus Christ right now already has authority. And he will accomplish the plan that has been established. By the way, it's not that Christ just suddenly had authority he didn't have before. I don't think that's the point he's making here. If you go back to Philippians, the second chapter, you read there that the one who was the Word relinquished his position as God to become a man. This is speaking here in Matthew 28 about Jesus resuming his full authority. That he's resuming now, as the resurrected Son of God, the authority that God had already given to him. We know he's the head of the church, and we know that he will fulfill the plan that is laid out, that he and the Father have prepared. So Jesus Christ is in charge. And when we see others clamoring of what's it, for years, at least 2 years, this campaign has been continuing. By the time they're finished, something like $2 billion will have been spent just on the presidential campaign. But we recognize and we certainly appreciate that the only real promise of hope and change comes from someone else. It's from Jesus Christ. I found myself considering and looking back, and I'll go back to Psalm 96. As we look at the world around us that's beginning to, or continuing, to go the wrong direction and to suffer the consequences, it's good to be reminded of the promises that we reviewed and rehearsed while we were at the Feast of Tabernacles. While we observe those fall holy days, there are a number of psalms, and Psalm 96 is one, that are actually prophecies of the millennium. We'll read the earlier verses, but just to establish that point, drop down to verse 10 here in Psalm 96. It says, "Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. The world also is firmly established. It shall not be moved. He shall judge the peoples righteously. This is a psalm which looks ahead to the time when Jesus Christ will reign on this earth. The word Lord here, the word that's translated Lord, is from the Hebrew word Yah, J-A-H. It's the root word of Yahweh, and is derived from the Hebrew word Hayah, H-A-Y-A-H, and that word means I am. Jesus described himself in John 8 as being I am, as being the God that was addressed as Yahweh, the covenant God who established himself with Israel. So my point is that when the word Lord is used here and speaking of him ruling over the earth, it's talking about Jesus Christ. This is a prophecy of Jesus Christ ruling over the earth. Verse 1 says, "Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Proclaim the good news of his salvation from day to day." What is the good news of his salvation? Well, it's the gospel of the kingdom of God. This is a time when the gospel, when the truth, when salvation through Jesus Christ will be taught to all of the earth. All people will hear it. "Declare his glory among the nations, his wonders among all peoples. For the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the peoples are idols. But the Lord has made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary." When my wife and I were over in Sri Lanka for the Feast of Tabernacles, it was a completely different culture than anything we've ever seen before. The people in that culture, in that land, there are very few Christians, first of all, in Sri Lanka. Most of those who are Christian are Catholic. They have had some missions there over the years. But the vast majority of the population are Buddhists, or they practice the religion of Hinduism or Islam. And probably 95% of the people in that nation are one of those three religions, and maybe 5% or less would claim to be Christians. Can you imagine what it will take to turn an entire culture around so that people who, for all of their lives and for all of their history, for thousands, the history of Sri Lanka goes back to 3000 BC. We study American history, it goes back 300 years. Would you want to be a grade school student in Sri Lanka and study that history? It goes back 3,000 years. And I think it was in the 1000s BC is when Buddhism was introduced into the nation, and it quickly took hold and it became the dominant religion of that culture. It has been for over 3,000 years. What's it going to take to turn all of those people to Jesus Christ? What an amazing shift and difference it will be. The Lord is to be praised above all their gods. And, oh, there are gods aplenty in that kind of a nation. It's not just there, but other nations as well. There are temples to Buddha or Hindu temples or Islam prayer temples literally on every block. And when we first started on our tour after the feast, the tour guide stopped. And he thought we were interested in all these Buddhist temples. And so he'd stop every few hundred yards, and there's one. So I would just kind of shrug and take a haphazard picture just to get him to move on. But I think he figured out after a while that we weren't all that interested in all those temples. But they worship these other gods, and somehow they're going to be turned around. They will worship Jesus Christ. Imagine what it's going to take for that to happen. "Give to the Lord," verse 7, "O families of the peoples, give to the Lord glory and strength. Give to the Lord the glory due his name. Worship the eternal," or the Lord, verse 8. in the beauty of holiness, say among the nations, the Lord reigns. The word nations is translated here in the New King James is often in the King James translated Gentiles. So it's speaking of all the non-Israelite nations of the earth, learning to turn and to worship Jesus Christ as he reigns. The world is firmly established. It shall not be moved. He shall judge the people righteously. Jesus Christ will bring that hope and change that people are so desperate for. He will bring the truth that they need. He will teach them who God is, and he will teach them to worship the true God. When I look at the world and the condition it's in now, it's just depressing. It hurts to consider the confusion and just how lost people are and how divided they are and what they believe. And there's a spirit in our nation right now of anger and division. And that there's a lack of, these politicians keep talking about having civility in our differences and in our debates. Doesn't seem to come across in reality. There's an anger that's there and a divisiveness that's there. Consider that compared to the time when the whole earth will rejoice together in worshiping Jesus Christ. For me to get past the anxiety and the just the feeling of this concern for the world that we live in, we've got to maintain the vision that we were given, the plan that we know is ahead. It's not just the world around us that can cause us to lose our sense of focus on those promises, even the things in our own personal lives. The challenges, the disappointments, the frustrations, the difficulties we face can overwhelm and obscure that vision. And it takes effort to redirect and to refocus so that we do remember, that we look ahead to the time that is to come, that we certainly live in this world and all that it, all the dangers and the hazards and the chaos of this world, but we look ahead to something else. Now I know, again, we talked about all this before the feast. We talked about it during the feast, and here we are again. But can we talk about the coming kingdom of God too much? We realize, don't we, that Jesus Christ made that statement in Matthew 6 to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And that these things, this world that we live in, must be something that we can put into the background and focus on what the plan is that we're part of. Otherwise, we'll be swallowed up. We'll be swallowed up by anxiety, by fear, by concern, by frustration. We'll be drawn right into the emptiness that people have around us. If we lose that vision is what allows us to continue, gives us a direction to go. Let the heavens rejoice and the earth be glad. Let the sea roar and all its fullness. Let the field be joyful and all that's in it, and the trees of the woods will rejoice before the Lord. All of the world, physically and certainly spiritually, will be at peace, will be able to rejoice. Verse 13, for he is coming. He is coming to judge the earth. Judge doesn't mean to condemn. It can, but in this case, it's not used that way. He's coming to direct and to lead. He'll judge the world with righteousness and the people with his truth. He'll lead and guide and reveal. And I keep saying it, but he will bring that hope and literally bring the change that mankind so desperately needs. Is our vision still intact a month later? We were observing the feast a month ago. Do we still see that vision? Do we still see the hope beyond what's been happening in the world around us and what we came back home to? Go back to Micah chapter 4. Micah, the fourth chapter. Verse 1. Micah chapter 4, verse 1. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above all the hills, and people will flow to it. Jesus Christ, we know, and this is a verse that we all are very familiar with, will establish that government, that kingdom of God, and it will take precedence over any other and all other leaders and mountains representing governments. And all will come to him to be taught and to learn. Many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we'll walk in his paths. Again, the nations could be translated the Gentiles, those who are all of the nations of the world, not just Israel, will come to God's throne, to the throne of Jesus Christ, to be taught his ways, and we will walk in his paths. Again, compare that, contrast that with the world we live in today. What a mess there is over there as a result of what happened in Libya. How confusing and frustrating is it to watch our leaders fumble and bumble and apparently not give us the truth about what happened in that situation. Now again, I'm not going to get tangled up in the politics of it. I'm thinking about the leadership, about the genuine and proper direction that can be given by leaders to provide security and safety. Leaders, I've heard governors say this in recent days. I've heard presidents and candidates say it, that their number one function is to protect the people. Okay. But how much of that do we really see in the world we live in now? That situation in Libya, it's not just Libya all by itself, it's that whole region in Africa and in the Middle East and on the Arabian Peninsula. All those nations are so entangled in all of the problems that go back thousands of years. There is no solution. Now, politicians claim that they can resolve it, right? How many presidents have had their big peace accords in meetings at the White House or in Jerusalem and they've solved the issues of the Middle East and the Palestinians and all the they don't realize that it goes back to Abraham and Ishmael and Esau. They don't realize that there are thousands of years of hostility and anger, and there was even a prophetic it's prophetic that these nations that came from those men would be at each other's throats all the way through the history of mankind. And they promise they're going to come along and solve it in the next 4 years. The complications of these difficulties between cultures and nations. Again, there's no solution. There is no solution, in spite of what some politicians may claim. Except for one, the nations will come to Jesus Christ and say, let's go to the mountain of the Lord. He will teach us his ways. We'll walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem, and he shall judge between many peoples. And he will rebuke strong nations that are far off, that are distant from Jerusalem. Jesus Christ will untangle those international and historic hostilities. No human being is going to be able to do that. The world is crippled by those entanglements, by the wars that result, by the terrorism that comes from it as well. And eventually, war will become obsolete because Jesus Christ will settle the differences. He will have the authority, the wisdom, and the love to bring about those changes. He'll judge between many people, rebuke strong nations. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. War will just be something that people will read about in history books and probably shake their heads and say, how could they have done that? How could it have been that way? The art, the skill of war will be changed, will be transformed into the use of resources for peaceful means. Jesus Christ will accomplish that. And as we look at the world around us, it can be very frustrating, very discouraging. But our spiritual vision reminds us that there's hope beyond what we see in this world. There's hope beyond what the emptiness and the confusion. They get so wearisome to have to hear about and to see in the world continually. Another verse that reminds us of what Jesus Christ will accomplish is in Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel 37, verse 24. Ezekiel 37, verse 24, David, my servant, shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd. So this is obviously talking about a time in the future when, after David has been resurrected, most specifically speaking of the time of the millennium, but in principle even beyond that into the time of the white throne judgment. David will be their king. One shepherd will rule over them. The great shepherd, of course, is Jesus Christ. They'll walk in my judgments and observe my statutes to do them. People will learn what they need to do to have what they want, what they need, what they look for in life. It has to do with hearing, as we saw in Micah, the ways and the law of God and seeking it so they can live by it. Verse 25, then they shall dwell in the land I've given to Jacob, my servant, where your fathers dwelt, and they shall dwell there with their children and their children's children forever. Think about the lack of security in the lives of people today. Most people, and surveys have indicated that a majority of people in our nation today feel that the next generation will not be as well off as they are. There's not an optimism about the future. There's a fear about the future. That the next generation is going to be stuck with all the debt that is being racked up, and with high taxes, and with fewer opportunities, and a narrower future. That's how most people view the future today, or at least how those who give thought to it and understand what the problems are. This is speaking of a time when there will be great optimism, when the wealth and the prosperity, the peace, the security will extend from one generation to the next. They'll dwell in their land with their children and their grandchildren forever, from one generation to the next. It wasn't until about almost 10 years ago that the phrase children's children meant very much to me. But as we get older and as we have children who have children, then that really begins to have an impact, that the promises of God extend through the generations, that every generation will live in safety and in peace. Verse 26, I will make a covenant of peace with them, an everlasting covenant I will establish. A time of peace, a time of safety, a time of security and prosperity, a time when the world, as they turn to obey Jesus Christ, will be free from anxiety. We don't live in a very safe world today, do we? Again, when we consider what's happened, just in terms of the natural disaster that took place earlier this week, the devastation that has resulted, the aftermath of the storm, the suffering that the people are enduring in those regions where the storm hit the hardest, there's no safety, there's no security. You may have seen the story of the woman whose two young sons were torn out of her arms by the raging floodwaters. And she went searching for someone that would help her. She was begging people in the area to help her find her babies. And no one came to her assistance. Of course, they were found dead a couple of days later. We live in a world that's insecure. We live in a world that's fraught with anxiety and fear. There's another nor'easter coming up the coast, most likely to hit in the middle of this coming week. Won't be as nearly as strong as what just happened, but considering the condition that's already there, the devastation and the tenuous living conditions, this world aches, and sometimes when we look out at it, and we realize what's happening all around us, we ache too for some relief. But what's most important to us is that we can keep that vision, that these promises are here, and that we can see beyond the world that we've come back to, the world we've come home to following our celebration of the world to come. We still live here, as we saw in John 17. We do have that protection, but we have a different sense of what the future holds. A time when God, with Jesus Christ, will make a covenant of peace. In other words, he'll make an agreement, a pledge, a promise to provide the security and the safety and the freedom from anxiety that people long for. A couple of chapters back, Ezekiel 34, verse 24. It's a similar prophecy. As we pick it up here in verse 24, we find again the promise of David being resurrected to be a prince over the people. Verse 25, I will make a covenant of peace with them and cause wild beasts to cease from the land. And they'll dwell safely in the wilderness and sleep in the woods. I'll make them and the places all around my hill or Jerusalem a blessing. I'll cause showers to come down in their season. That implies, a lot has been implied here in these verses, the change in the nature of animals themselves. But here the causing showers to come down in their season. You know, as advanced as we become with all of our smartphones and all of our technology and all that we have that we're so proud of, that we've invented and created, comes down to it, we all live off the land. The earth produces the food for us. And the implication here is that the world, the earth, will become productive once again. That the rain will come gently and timely and in due season. Not huge, horrible, devastating storms dumping feet of snow in the mountains and several inches of rain flooding the landscape. But a covenant of peace, of safety and security. in every aspect, with the wild beasts, with the weather, the changes that are to come that will restore this earth to what it should be. Did you think Jesus might be getting, I put this humanly, a little weary of recreating this earth? I mean, he had to do it after Satan rebelled. And he restored it to the excellence that we find described in the Garden of Eden. But when he returns again, he's going to have to rebuild one more time. He'll do so lovingly because of his care and concern. But finally, this time, mankind will be turned. Mankind will learn to follow him and to appreciate or to experience the blessings that he has, the prosperity, the peace, the security. Verse 27, the trees of the field shall yield their fruit, the earth shall yield her increase, they shall be safe in their land. They shall be safe. What a difference it is compared to the world that we live in now. The world will become, and the lives of the people living on this earth will become safe. For now, we see news reports, we hear or see video of people who have lost everything. Again, it sticks in my mind that the woman, middle-aged woman, who was just sobbing and crying, she said, "I've lived in this house for 42 years. And now everything is gone." And the woman who was saying, "I don't even have any clothes. The clothes I have on were given to me at a shelter. I have nothing." And people wandering the streets that were told even without shoes or socks. It's amazing how quickly the comforts and the stability we think we have in life can be taken away in a world that's not safe. And all that, much of that is happening just 400 miles away from here. You could drive there in 6 hours. It's right at our doorstep. Thinking about those things, seeing those videos, seeing the turmoil in this world and in this nation, I felt very unsettled this week. We live in a world that's falling apart. We live in a world that needs to be changed. We live in a world that we need to be able to see past and have a vision of what Christ has promised and what he will accomplish. And you know, all this is happening around us right now, this event and the storm over in the East Coast. It's just a tiny sample of what's going to happen in the future in terms of the suffering that has to take place before the time when Christ does return. Turn with me back to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Now, I want to read this carefully and not distort or misrepresent it in any way. Paul here in this passage is writing about the responsibility he has, that he's been given, the understanding he's been given of the gospel and the responsibility he has to take that message and to preach it in spite of the difficulties that he's encountered. But I think we see in this passage also a principle that applies to ourselves as well. That this is, we see in this passage something about ourselves and about the vision that has been given to us, as we've, again, experienced through the fall holy days. Verse 6, 2 Corinthians 4. It is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness, who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. We have been given this great view. The light has been shined in our lives, in our hearts. The light of the knowledge of the glory of God, the plan of God, what God is going to accomplish through Jesus Christ. That knowledge, that understanding has been given to us. And it is God Himself who has given us that security and that understanding. Verse 7 says, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels. God has given us this great treasure of knowledge, of understanding, of view, of vision of what He is going to accomplish and what His plan is. And we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. In other words, He chose people who could never say that they themselves have this understanding, this knowledge, this view, because they in some way deserve it, or they came upon it themselves. He's taken those who are least likely and given it to us to prove His power. Paul compares himself, and I'm extending it, comparing ourselves to these earthen vessels. In other words, we're just ordinary people. Earthen vessel means a plain-looking piece of pottery. Now, archaeologists have excavated these areas here in the New Testament times, and they find these pottery shards. And the people had quite a number of various kinds of pottery vessels in their homes for different functions and purposes. Some of them were very highly decorative and beautiful in and of themselves. Paul says that we, he compares us to, and himself to, earthen vessels, common, ordinary pottery. Now, in Paul's day, people didn't have a safe in their home to go lock things in. They didn't have a safety deposit box down at the corner bank at PNC. They kept whatever valuables and treasures they had right in their homes. And often what they would do, they would put them in an ordinary-looking piece of pottery so as not to draw attention to it. It would be hidden away, that this treasure of theirs, money or jewelry or whatever it might be, would be hidden inside of this very common-looking piece of pottery. And so that's what Paul is talking about here, that this great treasure we have of the light that God has shined in our lives, the knowledge of Jesus Christ, the way of life that has been revealed to us, the vision of the future has been given to very ordinary people. And we carry it about in our lives. He goes on to say that because of that vision, because of that understanding, because of that what God has revealed and given to him and given to us, then we have difficulties and struggles and trials. We're pressed on every side, but we're not crushed. We're perplexed, but not in despair. We have these experiences in our lives, but what keeps us going is that vision, that understanding of what God has given to us. And we see the importance, I think, of keeping that vision clear and keeping that vision unobstructed so that we do have that sense of purpose, of confidence, of optimism, even in the face of our personal difficulties and the world, the difficulties of the world that we see around us, that we're not, that vision of hope and of the future that we've been speaking of does not become obscured. He goes on to conclude in verse 16 that's why we don't lose heart. That's why we keep going. That's why we can look at the world around us and see what condition it's in and look beyond that to the hope that we've been told of. That's why we can deal even with the difficulties and the setbacks and the concerns we have in our own personal lives, because we see the purpose and we have a vision of what is going to be accomplished. Paul says in verse 17 that what we experience in this life is a light affliction compared to the glory that we will have. It's not that our circumstances aren't challenging and difficult, but in comparison, well, there is no comparison, considering what the promises are that are given to us. But you see, this is the vision. This is what we see beyond the immediate that helps us to be renewed day by day, as he says in verse 16. We look beyond the things that are seen to the things that are not yet seen, the things that are not that are yet in the future, the things that we've learned about, that we've rehearsed and we've celebrated. Satan does a pretty good job of trying to wear us down, trying to distract us, trying to obscure the vision that has been offered to us. Let's just look at one last passage in 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1, the opening verses here in this epistle are some that we're very familiar with and that have rich meaning. We could talk about the first 7-8 verses here for a long time, but I want to pick up on one phrase that's included here in chapter 4. Begin speaking in verse 3 of, I'm sorry, in verse 4, speaking of the promise that we have through the abundant mercy, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the promised, verse 4, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled, and that does not fade away. The promise that has been made to us, the vision that we should have of what is going to be fulfilled on this earth and in our lives, in spite of other circumstances, does not fade away. Now, our view, our vision of that promise sometimes can be obscure. It can be a bit hard for us because it fades from our view, but the promise itself never changes. The hope never changes in spite of circumstances. The New International Version puts the phrase this way: we're called into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. One of the challenges I think we face is to be sure that our vision does not fade, that our encouragement, that our hope doesn't fade. We carry that hope, that treasure, into our very ordinary appearing lives. We're earthen vessels, nothing special in and of ourselves, but we've been given that incredible treasure that is stored away in our lives, the promises that we base our lives upon, and that we've recently rehearsed in the holy days. And that promise never fades away. Once in a while, I think more often than every 2 years, it's good to have an eye exam, a spiritual vision examination, to be sure that in spite of the circumstances, in spite of the anxieties, in spite of the difficulties of this world around us, that we are not losing that vision of what has been given to us, or what God is going to accomplish, the promises that have been made to us. Our lives often become heavy with disappointment or anxiety. We see a world around us that is so chaotic and dangerous and difficult, and we see things happening that break our hearts. We must keep clear in our mind's eye the vision of the promise that does not fade away, that cannot perish or spoil. The contrast between this world and the world tomorrow seems to become more obvious and become more obvious just about every day. We see things, we witness things that are so different from what is going to be in the future. And with God's help, we can keep the vision that He's given to us clearly in mind. We can keep in mind the hope and the promise of God's kingdom. We can keep in mind the reality of the world that is to come, that will replace the world that is today. But it is essential that as we return, as we refocus, as we turn our efforts now to life, that we not lose that spiritual vision that has been given to us. So that as we continue doing the will of God in our lives, answering the call that we've been given, that we maintain that clear hope, that we remember the promises and the vision that has been given to us as we have observed the meaning and celebrated the meaning of those fall holy days.